Tonight, as we study John chapter 2, we start to move into the actual period of the ministry of Jesus. Leading up to all of these things, we have been looking at his birth, we've been looking at his early life, we've been looking at his baptism, and then last week, in dealing with the last sections of John chapter 1, we dealt with a number of things regarding his first in Matthew chapter 4, his temptation, and then in the latter half of chapter 1, his beginning interactions with individuals regarding who he is and what those mean. And we talked about Peter and Andrew and then Philip and Nathaniel and their interactions with Jesus. We are now going to be a short time in the future from the events of John chapter 1. John 2, and we're going to spend all of our time tonight here in John chapter 2. John 2 is going to begin with the phrase, on the third day. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that this took place 3 days later, but rather it seems to be indicating that this is a third day of consideration. If you notice back in chapter 1, verse 35, it says, and the next day. And then in verse 43, it says, the following day. And then in chapter 2, verse 1, it's, and the third day. And it's kind of just stepping its way down the list, as it were, of the things that John is wanting to talk about in these early days of Jesus. And so we don't know exactly how long it is from the events that are going to take place in Cana of Galilee here at the beginning of chapter 2 from the events in chapter 1. But we know it was at least a few days that is going to be separating these two sets of events. We are going to break chapter 2 down into three different sections this evening. The first one is going to be in verses 1 through 12. Where you have the wedding feast at Cana of Galilee. The second one is going to be in verses 13 through 22, where Jesus is going to go through and cleanse the temple for the first time. And then in verses 23 through 25, we're going to conclude tonight by talking about the mindset or the heart of Jesus. And so those are the three areas that we want to examine. Let's begin this evening by looking at the first 12 verses and looking at this wedding feast that takes place in Cana. We're going to read the entire section and then we'll come back and begin breaking it down. In chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, we read, on the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. Jesus said to her, woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. His mother said to the servants, whatever he says to you, do it. Now there were set there 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. Jesus said to them, fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast. And they took it. When the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom. And he said to him, every man at the beginning sets out the good wine. And when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. You have kept the good wine until now. This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. And after this he went down to Capernaum, he, his mother, his brothers, and his disciples. And they did not stay there many days. So here in the starting segments of John chapter 2, you have this situation with this wedding feast at Cana of Galilee. The indication seems to be that this was a wedding for somebody within the general family of Jesus and his mother Mary. They are attending this particular wedding feast, and they reach this situation where they have run out of wine. Now, I want to be careful here for a couple of different reasons. Number one, when most of the time when we consider John chapter 2, at least it has been my experience that we spend the majority of our time as far as members of the body of Christ arguing over whether the wine that Jesus made was alcoholic or non-alcoholic. And I've heard all of the arguments and all of the cases and all of those things that go on either side of it, and I have some very strong opinions about that particular thing, and we could spend the next 45 minutes talking about it. But I don't think that's the right approach to take to this particular chapter if we're really going to get the crux of what it is that we're supposed to learn out of the chapter. I do want to say just a couple of words about it. First of all, there are those who will point out that in this, the average wedding feast, or in the typical wedding feast in Israel, that there is a great likelihood that there was at least some alcoholic wine that was present at those particular occasions. But I also would warn us to be careful about making assumptions about things that are typically the case and turning it into some things that must always be the case. If you were to take into account a typical wedding in America today, you would consider that a typical wedding has all kinds of things present. It would have alcohol present. It would have dancing present. It would have many other things that may or may not be present. You may have bachelor and bachelorette parties that are going to be present surrounding such events. But just because that's typically the case doesn't mean that that must always be the case or is always the case. If you would have been one who attended my wedding, you would know that none of those elements were present at Shay's and my wedding. And we didn't want any of those elements present, even though they're typically found. Well, so just because everybody else is doing it, or just because it is the typical thing that might take place that we have records of in various other places, doesn't mean that it was the only way that things could be done, or the only way that people went about doing things. And the other side of things is we need to be very careful that we do not turn Jesus, no matter what side of the coin you want to come down on, that we do not turn Jesus into someone who is violating the law of God by creating a bunch of drunks and by creating a bunch of drunkenness, which, if we're not careful, we can wind up doing in this particular chapter because of the fact of the timing of when these things occur and the statements that are made by the master of the feast concerning the situation at that particular time. So, without spending the remainder of our time examining John chapter 2 from the context of whether Jesus did it in one way or the other, let's just be certain that as we go through and examine these things, and as we go through and look at these things, because the term wine is a generic term, in the original language, it was used for any product coming off of or coming out of the grape, any juice brought forth from the grape. It could be alcoholic. It could be non-alcoholic. When we hear the term, we automatically, in our day and time, from our vantage point, think alcoholic. It is not required that way. And it is not necessarily being utilized that way. It does not mean that every time the term wine is used in the New Testament, that it's meaning non-alcoholic. It also doesn't mean that every time the term wine is used in the New Testament, it means alcoholic. And so we need to be very careful that we do not find ourselves trying to pigeonhole every instance into meaning the same thing. We have to make sure we utilize it within the framework of the context and the things that are being said. But let's look at some things that we do need to see and that we do need to notice that are specifically stated and that are specifically being discussed in the from the standpoint of this event. First of all, we need to first see and recognize the fact that Jesus is not actively beginning his ministry yet. As a matter of fact, you're going to have a situation where Jesus is going to have his mother come to him and say, here, fix this, take care of this. And he's going to respond by saying, my hour has not yet come. It's not yet time for me to go through and to take care of all of these things and to start my ministry and all of these things to have occurred. And yet, have you noticed what Jesus' mother says? Jesus' mother responds to him in verse 5 by saying absolutely nothing more to him. She just looks at the servants and says, whatever he tells you to do, do it. And it is as though the situation is settled because Mama had given the orders. You know, there is a great lesson to be learned here about Jesus' relationship with his mother. Some have tried to turn verse 4 into a statement of belittling by Jesus when he says, woman, what does your concern have to do with me? And yet that's not the attitude and that's not the heart that Jesus is utilizing here at all. The word here for woman is a very respectful term. It is the term in the New Testament that is used for a woman or a wife in the New Testament. And yet it is a term of respect that is being utilized. You know, he's not looking at his mother and saying, woman, don't you know that it's not my concern for any of these things? But instead, he is speaking to her with respect. And he says, my hour is not yet come. But he is also going to be one. While this was not his first instinct to do something here, this was not his first choice to do something at this time in this place, he is going to listen to his mother. Notice, Mary doesn't tell him what to do. She doesn't tell him how to do it. But even though Jesus has not performed any of these miracles to this point, remember the statements that we've looked at previously, especially in Luke's account, where it talks about how that Mary kept these things in her heart. She remembered these things in her mind. Mary knows who Jesus is. Mary knows what Jesus has been sent to do and what he has been sent to be. And Mary is the one who is going to take it and say, the time is right. The time has come. And she is simply going to look at the servants and say, whatever he says to you, do it. And then, as it were, she walks away, leaving Jesus standing there. So you know what Jesus does? He doesn't go after her, arguing with her. He doesn't go off in a huff. He doesn't sit around and pout because he was told to do something that he wasn't planning to do. Instead, he turns and he takes care of the issue. He sends them to go fill the water pots. Each of these water pots is going to be 20 to 30 gallons apiece. For those of you who can do the math and are better at math than I am, that means you're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 120 to 180 gallons of wine that are going to be made by the time it is all said and done. These are going to be filled up, and these are going to be taken out. And the water that is going to be turned into wine, there was never a hand that touched it, as it were. Jesus didn't go around spinning his finger in it. He did not pronounce any great words over it. He did not in any way make any pomp and circumstance over what it was that was taking place. He simply had the water pots filled up and then says, okay, take from it and take it out and serve it. When they put it in there, it was water. When they take it out, it's wine. And not only is it wine, but it is described as being the best wine of the entire feast. As a matter of fact, the one who is the ruler of the feast is going to call over the bridegroom when he tastes it. And the indication is that the master of the feast was generally the first one to taste each batch when it comes out, or when it each round when it comes out. And he brings over the bridegroom, and he says, every man at the beginning sets out the best, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. But he said, what you've brought out now is the best of all. Jesus didn't just do enough. Jesus turned it into the best. And Jesus gave the best. This is going to be the first of the miracles of Jesus in the public sense. This is going to be the first time that Jesus is going to, as verse 11 states, manifest his glory. And yet it's going to be at the behest of his mother. It doesn't mean that Jesus had not prepared to do this. And it also doesn't mean that Jesus didn't want to do this necessarily. But you know, there are different people with different ideas of timing. And even though this was not the timing that Jesus had originally put forth in his own mind, he listened to his mother. You know, this goes back to some of the statements that we've talked about back in Luke chapter 2 when it comes to Jesus being in the temple and Jesus increasing in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man and various other passages as well. Here you see Jesus beginning his ministry at a time and at a place that in many ways wasn't of his own choosing. And yet it was effective, because it says his disciples believed in him. Now, they did not know everything that they were believing in. They didn't know everything that was going to come with what it was that Jesus was capable of doing and what it was that he had come to do and all of these different things. But they believe in him. They believe that he has power from God and that he is the one who was sent from God. And that's a building block. It's a starting point. So now let's move into verses 13 through 22, because here you have in verse 13, Jesus now moving forward again in time. He is going to come down to Jerusalem at the time of the Passover. And so in verse 13, we read, now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves, and the money changers doing business. When he had made a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. And he said to those who sold doves, take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of merchandise. Then his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house has eaten me up. So the Jews answered and said to him, what sign do you show to us since you do these things? Jesus answered and said to them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Then the Jews said, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking of the temple of his body. Therefore, when he had risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this to them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said. Here in these verses, we are going to have the first occasion, of Jesus cleansing the temple. And notice a couple of things as we go through this particular event. The first one is that as he comes into the temple, he begins to drive out the oxen and the sheep and the doves and the money changers doing business. Notice, he is not driving out the people coming to worship. He is not coming out. The people that are driving out, the people that are coming to offer sacrifices. Who he is driving out are the people that are trying to take advantage of the worshipers of God. The money changers in the temple were well known for being those who were going to charge exorbitant prices, and they were looking to make money off of people coming to worship. They were known to be dishonest, they were known to be untrustworthy, and they were known as those who would take advantage of anybody in a minute. And it is those individuals that are going to be driven out by Jesus. Jesus is going to make the statement in verse 16, "Take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of merchandise." You know, when the temple was originally created and when it was built, it was not designed to be a public marketplace. It was designed to be a place where people came together to worship God. It was designed to be a place where people met to get messages from God. And yet it has been turned into nothing more in that outer court area. It's been turned into nothing more than a marketplace for people who are looking to profit off of those who are seeking to serve God. Remember, this is not the first time Jesus has been to the temple. He's been to the temple multiple times every year for his entire life. So why now? Well, it's the beginning of his ministry. The time has come, and there is no better way to get the attention of the Jews than to perform this kind of action in the midst of the temple grounds. And the Jews do take notice. The disciples are going to remember what was written. "Zeal for your house has eaten me up." Now, this particular passage comes from Psalm 69, verse 9. And so it's going to be a quote from the Psalms, but this is what the disciples are going to be reminded of as they are standing by watching Jesus do this. Notice, Jesus doesn't call upon his disciples to do this. Jesus does not have the disciples join in and it become a mob or a gang that is coming in and making a mess of things. Jesus goes in and the disciples watch and remember. The Jews are going to come to him and they're going to say, "What sign, what signal do you show us since you do these things?" In other words, What is it you're trying to get out of this? What proof are you going to give us for these things? Jesus' response in verse 19 is, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Now, the statement in and of itself is a little ambiguous. It's intended to be, because his time is not yet there. His time to be killed is not yet present. And yet, if you tell somebody to kill you in a crowd of people, some of whom you've just driven out of the temple, then there will probably be one who would be more than likely, more than happy to take you up on that offer. And so Jesus' response is a bit ambiguous. He says, "Destroy this temple." Now, the Jews believe he's talking about the temple in which they're standing at this time, and they're going to respond accordingly. But he's not talking about the temple. He's talking about his body. Daniel?
So, Jews, would that have been all of those who were present, or Pharisees, or who? Would this have just been the population?
The indication is it's those that are gathered around that see this and that are around this. We don't know that it was necessarily a specific group, like the Pharisees or the scribes or the chief priests or whomever. The indication seems to be that it is simply those who have gathered around, they've been watching what's been going on, and they are responding to Jesus accordingly in the midst of that. Now, the Jews, in response to Jesus' statement, say, "It took 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to build it in 3 days?" In other words, they're incredulous. They do not believe that he is stating anything that in reality is going to take place. They are looking at him now as though he is somewhat crazy. from the standpoint of this particular statement. But they are going to listen. And this statement was made not so much to convince the Jews, but to be something that later the disciples will remember. Go to, when you look at verse 22, it says, "Therefore, when he had risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this to him, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said." He is laying down a foundation. You know, some of my favorite movies are those that are not as straightforward in their plot. And with such, they're dropping you hints. Maybe it's a mystery or maybe it's a thriller, but they're dropping you hints all throughout the movie of what it is that's coming, of what it is that's going to happen. But the problem is, until you get to the end of the movie and you see what it is that happens at the culmination, you don't put all of the clues together. You don't know all of the information that they've been giving you that's been sitting right there in front of your face the entire time. Well, that's what Jesus is doing here. Jesus is giving the disciples and the Jews that are present a piece of the puzzle. And yet, it's not a piece of the puzzle that they are going to be able to fit into that puzzle yet, because they're not even sure where in the puzzle it goes. The time will come when enough of the pieces of the puzzle are in place when they can take that piece and stick it in where it goes and see the picture clearly. But right now, that's not the purpose. It's not the time for them to have the entire picture, but he started handing out the pieces and setting them in front of their face. He is going to do this over and over again in many different ways, with many different statements and many different lessons over the course of the next 3.5 years. But right now, this particular statement looks like and sounds like it doesn't make any sense, like it's complete foolishness that is being stated, because there's no context for what's being said and why. In the same way that a puzzle with a piece that is just sitting there by itself without the rest of the puzzle to go with it is unable to be seen as to what it is that it's trying to depict, or a movie or a book that's only giving you the pieces of information that they want you to have at that moment without the full picture of how they all fit together. That's what Jesus does with this statement here in verse 19. When the time is right, the disciples will remember. They will be able to then put the piece where it belongs and know that from the very beginning, in Jerusalem, at the very start of his ministry, before there were great crowds, before there was a great following, before people were not just believing in him, but trying to kill him, Jesus already knew what was going to happen and what the result afterward would be. And yet he said it at the very beginning. Now let's take a look in our last few minutes this evening at verses 23 through 25. Because here you see the heart and mind of Jesus. It says in verse 23, "Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover, during the feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs which he did. But Jesus did not commit himself to them, because he knew all men, and had no need that anyone should testify of man, for he knew what was in man." Jesus is going to begin to garner a following, not just from his disciples, but from the people in general at Jerusalem. And many will believe in his name. In other words, many will believe that he is someone or something important when they see the signs that he does. And we're going to see this kind of an admission in chapter 3 when you get into Nicodemus coming to Jesus. And he says in verse 2, "Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him." There is this recognition that Jesus is someone special, that Jesus is someone important. But I want you to notice verses 24 and 25, and this is going to somewhat set up our study for the next couple of weeks, because we're going to examine into John chapters 3, 4, and 5 over the next few classes, as well as bringing in some of the other accounts from Matthew, Mark, and Luke as well. But I want you to notice the statement that John makes here in verses 24 and 25. It says, "But Jesus did not commit himself to them." To who? To this great number of people who have believed in his name when they saw the signs that he did. Notice, these are not his disciples which have come to him from Galilee. These are the people that have been in Jerusalem and have seen these things that have taken place, these events that have taken place. They believe in him, but their belief in him is shallow. Their belief in him is going to ebb and flow back and forth. It says in verse 24 that Jesus did not commit himself to them because he knew all men. He didn't need somebody to tell him what the heart of somebody else was. He didn't need somebody to tell him how he should act or what he should do or how he should approach or how he should explain any of these things, because he knew the hearts of men. And he knew at this time that there were a great many of those who were going to initially believe in him here that were not going to remain with him. They were not going to continue to develop that belief. They were not going to hold to him. As a matter of fact, a few chapters later in the book of John, you're going to have all but the apostles that are going to walk away and leave him because his teaching is too difficult as they see it. And that's when you're going to have Jesus turn unto the disciples and say, "Are you also going to leave?" Jesus doesn't commit himself. He does not fully put himself into these people at this point because he knows their hearts. Daniel?
I was going to ask about what it meant by commit. Like,
okay. The word commit, as a matter of fact, let me look it up real quick. Just to make sure that I give you the right one. It's a word that I had meant to look up beforehand, and I forgot to do it. So since we have our computer in front of us, we're going to cheat. And we're going to look it up real quick. The word commit comes from the word pistuo, which is the word in Greek that means to believe. In other words, while they believed in him, Jesus didn't put his faith in them. He did not put his belief in them that they were going to follow through, or that just because they believe right now, they're always going to believe. They're always going to follow because he knows their hearts. One of the interesting things from this particular vantage point in the book of John is that John 2, 24 and 25 is actually going to serve as the introduction for the next three chapters. Let me show you what I mean very quickly as our time begins to come to a close. It is stated here in chapter 2, verses 24 and 25, that Jesus knew all men, that he knew the hearts of men, no matter who they were, no matter what their background was. Well, how do you illustrate that Jesus knew the hearts of everyone? Well, first of all, you illustrate it by showing people from different perspectives. And that's exactly what John is going to do. In John chapter 3, you're going to have the Pharisee, Nicodemus, that is going to come to Jesus. And he is the spiritual elite. He is the top rung of the spiritual ladder in Judah, or in among the Israelites, as far as the people would be concerned. He's going to come, and Jesus is going to talk to him on his level, and he's going to lay things out for him that are even above his understanding. He knows how to talk to Nicodemus. In chapter 4, you have the woman at the well. This is the Samaritan woman. This is considered to be the lowest of the low, spiritually speaking, in the among the people of Israel, or among the nation of Israel. As a matter of fact, most Jews wouldn't even stop to talk to her. They considered her so lowly. And yet Jesus knows how to talk to her. He knows how to interact with her. He knows how to teach her concerning things. So you have the spiritual elite and the spiritual low. Then you come into the end of chapter 4 and you have the nobleman's son. The one who is the physical elite, has all kinds of money, has all kinds of position, has all kinds of power. And Jesus knows how to handle this man and his heart. And then you come to John chapter 5 and you have the healing of the man at the pool of Bethesda, who is the lame man, who is the lowest of the low physically. What is the point that John is making in John chapters 3, 4, and 5? That Jesus knew the hearts of all men. It didn't matter where they fell on the spiritual spectrum. It didn't matter where they fell on the physical spectrum. It doesn't matter whether it was a man, a woman, or a child. Jesus knew the hearts of all men. And it is because he knew the hearts of all men that he does not commit himself, he does not commit his belief, his faith, into the people that at this time, because of the signs, are enamored with him. Because most of them, ultimately, are not going to remain with him. So when you look at John chapter 2, it's not an overly long chapter. And there's no real lengthy discussions or interactions that take place. But I want you to notice what you see about Jesus here in this chapter. You see Jesus, who while a grown man at the beginning of his ministry, is still humbly obedient to his mother and still reverences her and her position, and begins his ministry at a time and at a place, in many ways, of her choosing instead of his own. You see a man who is beginning to get his message across, and yet he does so in ways that are not just about what people are going to know and understand right now, but he lays the framework for the things that are to come. And he doesn't get so enveloped and so overwhelmed in what people think of him now, because he knows the hearts of men and he knows where it ultimately will lead. These are the things that I have seen and that I pull out of John chapter 2. Excuse me. I hope that they are beneficial for you, and I hope that they are helpful to you. And so this is where we set. Next week we will come back and we will begin looking at John chapter 3.